of the Board of Commissioners here to make public comment tonight. Please.
Okay. Okay, there it is.
Breaking you by. Yeah,
Breaking by it. Good plan. Sebastian Elright with Humboldt Bay. Oyster Tours, Aqua Rodeo Farms, and Humboldt Bay Provisions. The topic for today, Air Quality in the Land Use Handbook, a Community Health Perspective, which was published by the California Environmental Protection Agency and the California Air Resources Board in April of 2005. A key term, sensitive receptors. According to this handbook, sensitive individuals are segments of the population that are most susceptible to adverse effects of poor air quality, specifically children. These groups require special attention because they are especially vulnerable to air pollution. When planning and siting industrial projects, evaluating the impact of sensitive receptors is a critical component of the environmental and public health protection. According to the South Coast Air Quality Management District, marine terminals and seaports are responsible for 15 to 20% of total emissions in the Southern Coast Air Basin of California. In land use planning, the term sensitive land uses is used to describe the physical locations where these vulnerable individuals spend significant time. Sensitive land uses or sensitive sites specifically include residences and residential communities. The Phyllis Rex Samoa Townhouse or Townhomes comes to mind, which is an 80-unit affordable complex on the Samoa Peninsula, the town of Samoa itself, schools and schoolyards. The Peninsula School, well, with the proximity to the industrial development within 1,000 feet to the north, comes to mind. Daycare centers, I think of Dream Athletics, which is kind of similar to that, which is a primary hub for youth sports training on the Samoa Peninsula. Digawatukt, formerly known as the Samoa Dunes and Wetlands, is a widely used recreation area in close proximity to the port development. Another key term, distributive justice. This involves communicating directly with impacted groups as partners and collaborators to ensure their voices are genuinely influenced project outcomes rather than just treating outreach as a checked box. Have any of the commissioners asked the principal at Samoa School about the port terminal project directly? Thank you.
Thank you. Any others caring to make public comment? Heather.
Evening, commissioners. My name is Kevin McKernan. If you've known me from previous appearances here, I kind of wear multiple hats, but don't worry, I won't ask for 3 minutes for each hat. I'll get by with this pretty quickly. Wearing my maritime community volunteer hat, I just want to announce that we have another captain's license course coming to Humboldt Bay in November. If you recall, one of the last times I was here, we had that course in 2004. At that time, the wind companies were still spending money in town and funded 15 seats. 17 participants took the class. 14 of those passed the class. At least four that I know personally followed through with the application process, which was pretty onerous to get their captain's license. Two of those are employed right away at the local tug company here on the bay, one with the Mattaket, and another one is imminent of being hired as a captain as well. So coming this November, I'll leave these flyers here, November 2nd through the 13th. Like I mentioned, there is no sponsorship this time, so it will be on participants or on entities like yourselves and the city. The city graciously sponsored the event by donating the Wharfinger building for 2 weeks, which is a good amount of time that they're not receiving rent for it, equal to about $5,000. So that's coming up. So spread that around, spread the word. We need more trained, qualified captains in our area. Take that hat off. Putting my hat on as the director of the Yurok Tribes Marine Department. Wanted to make an announcement that April 23rd, in a couple of weeks, the Yurok Tribe and Surf Rider Foundation are sponsoring a documentary filming of Sequoias of the Sea, which is a documentary about the devastating loss of the kelp forest in Northern California, primarily Sonoma and Mendocino counties, but also the inspiring story of local communities rallying together to reverse that. So that'll be April 23rd, the Arcata Theater. I don't have information on that other than to look it up. 2 days after that, the Klamath River cleanup is going on the Klamath River, hosted by the Yurok Tribe. And we will also be hosting a filming of that Sequoias of the Sea there in Klamath for folks up to the north. And then just finally, I'll say that the Yurok Tribe Marines program is now equipped with a 34-foot multi-use vessel, has a Coast Guard certification for 11 passengers. It is also certified and qualified to go out in the ocean, not just near shore. It's available for a charter, for scientific work, for just sightseeing tours, all those types of things. Currently, it's berthed up in Crescent City, but it will be available for use up and down the whole coast, Eureka, Trinidad, and everywhere in between. So, and then last, the Yurok Marine Department does also have a remotely operated vehicle now, basically an underwater robot that's capable of taking high quality images and video. We'll be using it for research, but it can also be used for inspecting infrastructure and boat hulls and everything else. And that is available for, a fee as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you for all that information. Anyone else caring to make public comment tonight? Anyone online? We're just talking about this. You can hit star 9 if you're on a phone to unmute. Otherwise, use the raise hand function on Zoom. All right. Then moving along to the consent calendar. I have quite a few charter agreement renewals on that. It's always good to see.
I move to approve.
We have a motion and a second. Since it's a consent calendar, we can go straight to a vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Consent calendar passes. Thank you. Communication reports and correspondence received.
No correspondence received.
All right. And the reports.
Okay. Thank you. Whoops, that's a little wonky. It's like our electronics aren't cooperating tonight. That's okay. Let's start. If we have to hit the enter button a couple more times, we will. So we have the Harvard Kennedy School visit us up here to talk about not only economic development, but public policy. They met with the city of Eureka, County of Humboldt, and Humboldt Bay Harvard District. So we gave them a little tour in and around the waterfront in Eureka. I spent about an hour with them. I was happy to join Swan Asbury from the city of Eureka and Peggy Murphy from the County of Humboldt. It's pretty neat little engagement. I was, in some cases, schooled by some of the questions that were asked, but able to come up with answers. But these were some pretty amazing students. So they did a visit here to Humboldt and a number of other areas. We were happy to host them. Attended the California Energy Commission Proposition 4 workshop. This is the initial workshop on the competitive process that the district will apply to receive money under Proposition 4. We'll be issuing a comment letter. We have an open period to comment on that, and there are some things that we would like to share. We're working with our project partners in and around the community to help sustain that effort. We recently had a hearing for our coastal development interim use permit at Redwood Marine Terminal 2, which allows us to have interim uses there, which are not necessarily fully CDI. And that was extended for additional 3 years. And so I'd like to recognize the County of Humboldt's efforts on there. Steve was our planner and the strong support from Planning Director John Ford. Also, Vanessa for processing this permit for us on our side of the equation and working to collect tenant data with her team. So successful. We are still in business RMT2. We had our City of Eureka 2x2 at the beginning of the month. Thank you to the commissioners who support us in that, as well as a county 2x2. I want to point out that these meetings are growing. There's new topics. There's new levels of cooperation. So we're really excited about that. So appreciate all of you that serve on those committees. Let's see, CEC Proposition 4. Why is that on there twice? That must be part of this little glitchy deal here. Ordinance number 9 and ordinance number 21 are progressing, continuing to meet with tenants. Had a meeting with one of our more active live aboard tenants here, and still have a few more people to run down in terms of ordinance number 9, but it's looking like we're on target to bring that to you in May for some recommendations and ultimately adoption. Same with ordinance 21. There's a little bit going on out in the administration. We talked about this at the last meeting. There's also been some developments of some potential ordinances that are being adopted in other areas. So those are currently under review and discussion, and also working with our district council on bringing that back. So want to make sure that those are still in play. Finally, we have the 2026 dredge schedule out. So usually we begin with the Aquinnah for federal channel dredging work. The Aquinnah is now delayed or even canceled. So a bit of a setback. Partially, it has to do, well, most of this has to do with funding and money that's appropriated and how it's been allocated. The Army Corps dredge Essions, which is our barn interest dredge, is still inbound. It's going to be here on May 10th, as currently scheduled, for 8 days and up to 300,000 cubic yards. And this, the number one form of disposal of this dredge material is nearshore placement because it's perfectly suitable for that. The goal would be to use as much of that dredge material as possible for our nearshore placement, and the Corps is still continuing with that. So very happy for that. Finally, Mansum was awarded the West Coast Dredge Hopper contract for 600,000 cubic yards, which will come out of the barn entrance. And even though this was a very tough financial year, we were lucky enough to receive an option for an additional 300,000 cubic yards. So it looks like and that's the scheduled amount. There'll be some over dredge, but we could be back at 1 million cubic yards just on the West Coast dredge copper contract. So once again, very grateful. We continue to have exceptional support from the Army Corps of Engineers and some of our elected officials that really support this at a federal level. Yeah, what more can you say about it? And we've really just have this never-ending level of support there. So I want to really take a moment and consider what the Army Corps does here in the Port of Humboldt Bay. So then again, Kevin brought up get your captain's license locally. Karen, this is a big deal for us. This is really important here in Humboldt Bay. We have an aging pilot fleet, if you will. I'll call them pilots. Or captains. We also know that we have a hard time attracting bar pilots, and it would be nice to get some people to get in at a younger age and start this program where there's time to work and put in their sea time and be able to become potentially bar pilots or tug captains. I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to be done here, so we're grateful. Thank you, Kevin, for bringing the Maritime Institute back to us. The district is sponsoring a scholarship, possibly too, if funding permits, for people to attend, and I'm talking with one of our staff members to encourage if they might participate in this. So that's my report for tonight.
Thank you. Looking you around.
Oh, next. Just want to let you know that so dredge materials, whether we dredge the marina here or the Corps dredging the bar. An entrance in the navigation channels. The majority of the material is dumped in the ocean. And there are opportunities to use that material in beneficial ways. Permitting of it is challenging. And so we've been doing a collaborative effort with a number of different regulatory agencies to do a problem-solving workshop to see how we can increase beneficial reuse of dredge materials in the bay. So looking at permitting pathways and constraints, realistic options, viable paths for beneficial reuse, and learning from real-world examples. So there are other parts of the state and nation that have a lot of success with beneficial reuse. So where we have representatives of regulatory agencies from other parts of the country serving as guest speakers in this workshop. So I'll keep you updated as we learn more about that.
Mic drop.
Are there proposed dates for
Pretty
that
excited. Yeah,
public
that's what I
workshop?
was not quite yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. This next is Mike, engineer report or council. Do we have a district council report?
We all have a district council here, so
engineer.
Yeah, we just got to continue to support the district. Primarily, we've had that regional board was up on inspection, field landing last week. Field started, and we're rounding up and getting ready to put out the bid for it. So that should be on next month's agenda for the stormwater treatment system. Just wrapping up that bid package. Let's see. We did help out support Moffitt for some of the work. And then let's see, our IGP inspections and our alcohol line. And still looking at some options up and support the district with the alcohol line and short placement. It's kind of an older slide here.
These are all the things that you and your staff are continuing to
Yeah,
support us on,
okay.
so I went ahead and left
Yeah.
it in.
There anything new happening down in Shelter Cove or just still working on?
Actually, there's a request from one of the neighboring property owners. The Mario's Marina building was recently red tagged because the bluff is just sloughing away, and it's outside of our permitted footprint. It's outside of our jurisdictional footprint, but we are trying to work with and advocate for opportunities for that property owner to potentially save the property and the historic structure there. So, Mike's through Jason Iceland, who's the engineer work overseeing that project, has been an advisor in helping us on that. Thank
Mr. President, am I allowed to go back and ask Rob a question? Can I go out of order?
Sure, why not?
Just okay.
Junior.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. And thank you, Mr. President. I'm just curious if the next time we're going to have the consultants here around the heavy lift marine terminal, the next consultant report.
Yeah, probably about 8 minutes from now.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
It just didn't come with your report. All right.
Oh, it's usually as a unfinished business
Thank you. All right. I'm
item.
clear now.
This
I'm going to
status
have another
update.
sip of coffee and
That,
clear
we
the
have to get through all the reports and we have to hear what we all have to talk about, and then we'll get to
Thank you.
that.
Vanessa.
And mine will be quick. Just continued permitting on a lot of the stuff that we have been working on, continuing to work with Humboldt Bay Oyster Co. To respond to the CDFW letter. And continuing to support with other district staff and consultants on the eelgrass sampling plan and some coordination there. The Pacific Shellfish 10-year permit renewal and extension. And then quite a few Coastal Commission CDPs that we're responding to additional information requests and preparing applications for extensions. And ongoing coordination with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife about the Wadu Lagoon as well.
Thank you.
That's my report.
Appreciate it. Commissioners, does anyone care to start? Anyone have a
Nothing to report.
Greg?
I do. I'm going to read some of it from my notes just so I remember. So I had this wonderful opportunity this week to meet with Ted Kuyper and Todd Van Herp and Bill Rich at the Humboldt Bay Oyster facility and right next to the Wadush wetland. And I just had such opportunities to learn more about aquaculture baywide and their site-specific aquaculture, culturing via the flupsy and the raft and bag and the rack and bag. And I have a better understanding of those techniques, not being a specialist in that. So I really appreciated them sort of walking me through it. And some of the site-specific culturing of Manila clam seeds at that site, babies just several millimeters, and called seed, in this industry. We also talked about, real and perceived existential threats about to maintaining Humboldt Bay's high health status, which is we're lucky to have, and how that high health status has been lost elsewhere, up and down the coast, and just how lucky we are here. And our conversation started really broadly, and they mostly generated around, biosecurity and disease, but we got into some small details of harmful algal blooms and dinoflagellate cysts in sediment and paralytic shellfish poisoning, lots of acronyms there, and domoic acid. And then we kind of hourglass back to broad, to talk, talk more about sea level rise and worries about sewage contamination, a lot of science-based threats around Humboldt Bay. And these topics really, for me, really frame their their real overarching concerns about water quality, and it amplified for me just how critical water quality is not only to their industry but just about everything we do here in around WIGI. And then we quickly moved into their very specific concerns about the heavy lift marine terminal, and it was a real topic for the meeting. It's really why they wanted to meet with me, and I really appreciated having consequential conversations with people who are very informed business people and whose businesses are forced them to be hyper vigilant about the environment and water quality in particular. And I won't speak to all the details of the things that we spoke with. I spent 3 hours with them, because some of these are going to be summarized in future, you know, correspondence and via the Aquaculture Advisory Committee, et cetera. My intent in talking to you about to the commission about tonight, just to give you, you know, we have speakers in the aquaculture community fairly regularly, but just to give amplify the heads up and concerns about about some of the questions. There's many questions that are going to be coming our way around the project description for the heavy lift marine terminal, and our upcoming CEQA document. And so really smart people are going to ask a lot of really informed questions about legitimate concerns. And please note that I also encourage them to come to our monthly Harvard Commission meetings, where that we get updates, and that Rob usually leads it with our consultants. So that's a really good opportunity to get really specific information. And our goal is to try to let the public hear those concerns, or hear every step of the way, every piece of the process, so they're not excluded from anything, and then incorporate their recommendations in a really proactive manner into the CEQA document. That's way better than just getting comments after the fact, although those are also acceptable. But we're really trying to create opportunities, and through the community advisory committees. And then the last thing I want to express tonight, from my meeting with Humble Bay Oyster folks, is that there's, and we've all heard this from the other advisory committees, there's just a burnout factor. There is inherent in a project that takes so long to develop. There's so many documents to review, and there's almost an overabundance of participation opportunities, and it's hard to pick, where's the bang for the buck. And so I appreciate everyone and everyone here tonight who comes and participates in the many committees and work groups around this heavy lift marine terminal. And I remind myself weekly that this is a marathon, not a sprint. And I've been on this Harbor Commission almost 4 years, and it appears that I'm gonna have to run for Harbor Commissioner again just to be part of these continuing ongoing discussions and decisions that still have to be made about this project. So it was a great meeting, and I just wanted to share in some detail about it. So I appreciate your patience in hearing me out.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Commissioner Dale.
Well said, Craig. Well said. I don't have anything to report.
Nor do I. Thanks. Just want to report out on a couple events that I'm aware of coming up on the 17th, so next Friday, which is good. I just checked my calendar. I thought it was tomorrow. There's a WIGI networking event happening at the Humble Bay Social Club. And I guess it's also a fundraiser for the Frank Shaughnessy Scholarship Fund. And I think there's information on that on
Humble. Is that the California Estuary Institute, the CEI group, doing that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I think it's also on Humble Waterkeepers website. There'll be some speakers and poster sessions and things like that. And then on May 8th at the Blue Lake Rancheria, there's going to be a training called Pathways to Trust, which is part of a larger certification program for governments and developers wishing to work in Indian country. And so I'll be attending that on behalf of my day job. We're helping to co-sponsor that a little bit. And I don't know, if, I'm sure we've had some involvement on behalf of the district as well.
Yes.
And then I will not be in attendance for our next meeting in May. So I have to also stay that. So you'll be in good hands with our vice chair.
Okay. Nor will I.
Benson. Oh, okay.
I think I will be up.
I guess we'll have to confirm that we'll have a quorum and Yes, there's the option to reschedule if we need to, or yes, go ahead, but we'll handle that. All right, so we'll move on to unfinished business and the aforementioned received status update regarding the Humboldt Bay Offshore Wind Heavy Lift Marine Terminal Project.
Thank you, Chair. So the project has now been reactivated. We were in hibernation for 7 months, a little bit of activity, but really not a lot occurred. So we're back on track now. The WFIP grant has not yet been activated, but some major submittals occurred yesterday evening. So hopefully by the time we meet again, that will be active. Some advisory committee meetings have started up again. Others are restarting this month. And then we have a public meeting tentatively scheduled for June 25th to be hosted by the community advisory committee. They've been working on this for a while. Had we not gone into hibernation, that would have occurred by now. And I went into great detail about this last month. I'm not going to do it again unless you'd like me to. That's a graphic. Feel free to take a picture. And then here's kind of a bullet list of critical dates to know. Happy to come back to that if you'd like. I mentioned this June 25th. Tomorrow morning, we'll be confirming that the Arcata Community Center is still available. If so, then that date will get locked in. Pretty exciting public meeting. A lot of people working on that, station speakers and panel. And it'll be the first public meeting for this project outside of the city of Eureka. So for whatever that's worth. And a publicity campaign will begin next week. So we welcome feedback on the best way to get the word out. And there's two board meetings between now and then, so we will talk about that more. And hopefully a guest speaker from the Community Advisory Committee will come before you and walk through what to expect at that public meeting. I want to acknowledge some concerns from various impacted parties and affected communities, as well as our committees. Commissioner Benson taught this term to me, so we no longer use the term stakeholder. Is impacted parties and affected communities. So I just want to acknowledge there's been some frustration regarding the district's timeliness in addressing requests for information and answering questions. I'll own that. I understand the frustration and just want to acknowledge that we're working on that. Also want to acknowledge frustrations regarding unfulfilled requests to participate in design activities. Not exactly sure how to deal with that, but Executive Director Mickelson and I are working on thinking that through and figuring out how to get people involved. I also want to acknowledge frustrations regarding unfulfilled requests to participate in field studies. So later this evening, we're lucky to have Shelley Anghera with us again, and she'll be talking about some of the results of some field studies. And you've got staff participating in that, or their PhDs in ecotoxicology, and master's students in chemistry going out in the field fulfilling EPA standard requirements on how to do field testing. There's no creativity to it. It's just a lot of work and bringing mud back and sampling it and putting in jars. So we're still sorting out how to get people to participate in field studies and welcome feedback on that. There's been questions, our advisory committee's really providing advice to the board, and we want to do a better job of that. Staff recommendation is yes, we do want these advisory committees to provide advice to you. How to implement that, we're looking to do better. Really, so far, we haven't done that very well. And one way I want to do that is to have committee members come and speak during the monthly staff report. So the community advisory committee can talk about the upcoming public meeting. The aquaculture committee could be part of a staff report talking about the range of concerns that they have. And we can have some of our technical speakers from the Moffitt team participating in that. We've got the recreation advisory committee, the fishing advisory committee, and the town of Samoa steering committee, all of those. Will likely be guests in the coming months. And we will double our efforts to hear and respond to the interests and concerns of the community and our advisory committee. So just want to let you know, now that we're back online, got a lot of resources with our consulting team. Hopefully, we can tackle these concerns in the coming weeks. Technical speakers. Like I mentioned, we're lucky for the second month in a row to have Shelley here with us. She's going to talk about field observations of the sediment investigation number one. And then Josh Singer is in Boston and talking about foundation assembly. And well, we've got the slides in there. I was going to say we should let Josh go first because it's so late there, but I'd have to flip through your presentation first. Can you see Josh? Is he present?
Want to start with him?
Yeah, let's start with Josh.
Hello. Can you hear me? Oops, hello? It went off mute, but I can't. I guess you guys can't hear me. Wait.
More. There, Josh, we can almost hear you. I think it's on our end, but it might not be. Nope, it's not on our end. Barely hear you.
Okay, hold on. How's that?
Not much better.
One sec.
Now you're getting better.
Yeah. Is that any better?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Okay.
Do you want to share your screen with your slides, or do you want me to advance them for you?
Yeah, I'll share, but it says share. The host is not isn't allowing sharing.
Yep. 10 seconds.
Okay.
How about now?
Let's see. Yep, that'll do it. Let me just switch these screens. Oh, what is this? Is that working? Can you see my screen?
Anybody that wants to move to better see the screen?
If you shift yourself seats to the right, you'll see the screen better.
I like them both off. How's that?
It's up here too.
Sure, Ted asks.
Josh, you've presented here several times, but could you please reintroduce yourself and your role in the team?
Sure. Yeah, my name's Josh Singer. I've been working for Moffitt and Nickel for about 11 years. I am a marine structural engineer pore planner. I've been doing that for about 25 years. I run the global offshore wind practice for Moffitt, and for the Humboldt project, I am the lead technical advisor. So helping out with like making sure that the terminal, what we design, fits with our current state of operations, logistics, things like that.
All right, floor is yours.
Okay, so today I'm going to talk a bit about foundations that are potentially going to be produced at the Humboldt, at the heavy lift terminal, the Redwood Marine Terminal, once it gets built. And the differences between some of the types of foundations that may get built, right? So this is just to kind of set the baseline here. What we're looking to do in Humboldt is get a offshore wind port facility that'll service the industry, not just in Humboldt, but for, potentially up and down the West Coast. And in order to do that, you need areas that will deal with the wind turbine generation components, which is the white stuff that goes on top, and then also the foundations, right? So like, this is one rendering. It isn't the exact rendering that we have now, but basically it's demonstrating that when you look at the north side here, you're seeing the WTG components. And then when you look at the south side, am I doing that right? Yeah. When you look at the south side, the triangular yellow things, you're seeing the foundations, right? So in order to service the industry, the port will have to be able to do both things. If they get all of the stuff imported and then assemble build the foundations out and then put the WTG components on top, right? So This talk that I'm going to give is going to focus on the foundations and how those foundations are going to get brought to the port, and then have the difference in some different types of foundations. No, I got to do this. Okay. So when we talk about offshore wind for foundations, there's floating foundations. There's primarily three types. You've got, they all float. and they're all anchored to the bottom, right? They have different configurations. The one that's been used that's out there in the world but won't be at the port is the spar. It's not feasible at the port because it's got to be the foundation has to be pulled back to the port quay or the wharf in order to get the components on top of it, and the length of this spar is about 100 feet, so we're not going to have that much water. So that one's not feasible to be produced at Humboldt. So we're looking primarily at the semi-submersible and tension leg platform foundations. Those are very, very similar. They're floating platforms, and the semi-submersible is anchored with a catenary system, so like an anchored boat, and that has a bit of travel to it. And then the tension leg, the anchors that you see there, that's the yellow one on the right, those are in tension, right? It's a bit more difficult, a bit more tricky. Right now, it looks like things are headed in the semi-submersible direction. Right. Right. And then when you look at the types of foundations, they're somewhat similar, but the material that they're made of can really either be steel or concrete. So they're circular, triangular, square. The main dimension across one side of them is about 300 to 450 feet. And then the difference in weight, depending on the material and how much material is in there, can have quite a range. It can be anywhere from like 3,500 tons to about 25,000 tons. There's a calculation that's done like a weight to power output ratio, and that's kind of how they're calculating like which one of the ways that they choose the foundation type. But like, I think for this slide, what you want to get out of it is that the foundations are relatively similar. They're big, like floating barge type structures, and they are made out of either concrete or steel or some combination of both, right? Okay, and then when you look at what's used in the world right now, you got to remember, okay, so in the North Sea, there's something like 54 gigawatts of wind installed. And then in China, there's something like 54, like maybe 60 gigawatts of wind. Those are all fixed bottom projects that have been installed. Floating is still kind of in its infancy demonstration project scale. There are projects that are on in line commercially to be installed, but right now it's smaller projects. Okay, so right now there's 193 megawatts, not gigawatts, installed for. That are installed with, and then there's one semi big next demonstration project that's under construction being installed right now. And you can see that the foundation materials vary, right? The one that is being installed right now is actually concrete. Some of the ones that have gone in the past, like the King Cardine and Windflow Atlantic, those are both principal power foundations. Those have been steel, and then some of the spars have been hybrids, right? So you could see like both of them are viable. The decision is up to the developer which foundation they want to use. Okay. All right, so as far as the port goes, the infrastructure and the yard equipment required is basically consistent for both types, right? The like doing one versus the other for the port for like my department, which is like the technical department, the marine infrastructure, the uplands, and the well the operate yeah and really the operations, like the port looks the same. Basically, we're the terminal is just gonna have a straight quay, straight wharf face across. It's gonna be like 6,000 PSF for the wharf, 3,000 PSF for the upland, big open space. And then you could see some of the equipment. This is for fixed bottom that you're seeing here, but it it's relatively the same. You're gonna have the SPMTs moving the components around the port, really large crawler cranes working the foundation yard, working some of the component yard, and then ring cranes doing the integration, right? So like the steel versus concrete foundation is not really gonna differentiate what has to be built and what type of equipment is gonna be brought in. The foundation, the concrete foundations are the heavy ones. Those are the ones that can go up to 25,000 tons. If there's additional support or upland support needed, the developer will install that at the port during their use of the facility, right? So, like, they may be like, oh, I need some extra support here. Typically, you say, like, yep, that's all right. And then you'll have some engineer, either us or someone else, review that just to make sure it doesn't degrade the use of the terminal, and they can install any extra support that they need. It's very typical in the industry. But as far as like what we're delivering, what we're permitting in the CEQA, like the actual infrastructure is not different for either foundation as far as the infrastructure goes. Okay. All right. So this is like start the steel foundation components are delivered to the port on either like a large geared vessel, which means that the vessel is going to have cranes on it, or they'll be delivered on these large like flatback vessels coming from, primarily Asia, where like coming from where large steel things come from, right? Which right now is primarily Asia, maybe like maybe the Middle East, Turkey, some of those areas are they're building piles now, so it's feasible that they will do offshore floating offshore wind foundations. The like I said, you see some of the dimensions here, it's big stuff. And then you can see on the right, it's the two main components for steel are the columns and are which are the vertical members, and then the struts which go in between the columns. Okay, yeah, this is the important one. Okay. So when we talk about foundations, the big thing to remember is that the best way to get it in your mind is like steel foundations are assembled and the concrete foundations are produced. We'll go over the concrete in a second. The steel foundations, it's highly likely that they will be delivered in those two component types, which you can see on the right there. The circles are, this is looking at plan. So you've got the columns and the struts. And then those components will be bolted together. So there's not like this large welding operation that welds this stuff on the site. The components are typically bolted together. And it's usually like the thought is, and what's happened in some of the demonstration projects, it'll be a serial production line where like you'll start in the back and add some components to it, or add some struts or columns to it, push it to the front, where you're going to launch it at the face of the quay. You could also imagine this line horizontal to the quay, or like parallel to the quay, sorry, and they'll build four in place right at the quay and then pluck them off the quay, or put them on, launch them as they're done, right? The two big things on the slide is that the connections are bolted and that the loadout is with a semi-submersible barge, right? So that's they take like in order to launch them, they'll be put on the SPMTs and rolled across the quay onto the barge. Then the barge moves away from the berth, sinks, and the foundation comes off the barge.
Josh,
Yep.
are the steel foundations painted before they arrive or painted on site?
Yep. So they'll be painted before they arrive. Like you could see, it's very similar to this, right? So like all of this stuff is painted either, white for the top and yellow for the foundation typically. So the primary paint job will be fully complete, ready to go in the water. There may be some touch up on the site, but like the idea that would be if something is damaged. The idea is to ship it from the manufacturer fully ready to be installed.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, gotcha. Commissioner Benson, a follow-up question to that.
Yep.
It's arriving, painted already, and I hear you say there may need some touch-up if there was some damage. I mean, inevitably there's going to be some little bit of scraping or something, and that
Yes.
touch-up happens. Does that happen in a separate building with cover to ensure air quality, or does that just happen in the open air? I'm
Yeah.
curious what that would look like, and I'm also curious whether at some maintenance interval they're brought back in, and at what point do these need to be repainted, if ever?
Yeah, they're not they're, they don't need to be repainted. So the paint, the life of the wind of the typical life or the expected life of a installed farm, it depends on like what insurance it's based on like an insurable time frame, and that's ranging anywhere from like 25 to 35 years right now. So the paint is made to last that. As far as the touch up, it really depends on where you're doing it and who's doing it. You could likely enforce that, like, all painting needs to be covered. A lot of times what they'll do is cover the specific area that they're painting, you know what I mean? Almost like a bridge painting, right? Like it, when they're repairing a bridge, it's enclosed. Something like that would be typical.
Just be aware that those triangles are larger than the Arcata Plaza, so putting that in a building is tricky.
Yeah,
Yeah.
like an airport hangar, a blimp hangar size building. Yeah, I get that.
You're gonna like, I've seen them pull them back. There have been, and it's basically, that's what it looks like. It's like a bridge repair. There'll be scaffolding on it, and then that's cover.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so then we get to concrete, and the biggest difference between if you're gonna do concrete foundations is you're not delivering the components of it, you're delivering the materials for concrete, right? So you're delivering the cement, the aggregate, any admixtures. You've got to pull in water into the pour, like not, like on a more industrial scale. And then you're also delivering the steel reinforcement, right? So like you're gonna see, like, this is like a hopper barge here. The most efficient way to get it to the port is by, either self-powered barges like this, self-propelled barges, or barges, tug, propelled barges, bringing the aggregate. It really just depends on the area. It could also be brought in trucks, or it could be a combination of both. The like, again, these things are gigantic. So the truck traffic, like it hasn't been done on a commercial scale, but like when you can't, the truck traffic can be significant. The water traffic is not that significant. You're getting enough of that in there on the barges that, like, you are, you're it's not like a super significant activity. Okay. And then, yep. So this one, like I said, the way you should look at it is the steel foundations are assembled and these are produced. This is a port in Maine that we're working on, and like this is a good representation of what you may see for a concrete, like a port that has the capability to produce concrete foundations. Basically, you have a mobile batch plant that is brought to the port, and that's where the con that you have a storage bins or pens for the different materials. They'll be stored on site. They can be covered. And then, like these are like mixing parts to the batch plant, right? And the batch plant is mixing the materials, just like a land bait or like a permanent batch plant. Takes materials, mixes them up, produces the concrete. There is probably going to be like there may be an additional building that the developer or the found whoever they hire to build the foundations will put up. That it'll be a temporary building. That they may do some precasting or, yeah, like precast some elements that they're going to put together. It's going to be both precast and cast in place, likely, right? And then it's basically the same procedure, right? Like you're going to maybe this base is cast in place, right? So they'll produce a lot of concrete, pump it over to here, pump it into forms over here, and then slide the foundation down a bit. These may be precast elements, the columns, they'll pop those on, push it forward till they get a finished foundation. And then just like steel, load it onto the semi-submersible barge, pull it out and get it buoyant. Okay. Is this the last slide? Let's see. Oh yeah. Okay. I just one other thing is like there's some pros and cons. Okay, like when you look at the labor for concrete, there potentially is more local labor involved. Like the local labor force is highly likely to already be trained in how to make big concrete structures, right? Like a bridge. It's really nothing different. So the biggest potential advantage for concrete is the local, the like, you know, whether they're fully trained or primarily like mostly trained to do this, the ability to grab local workforce and put them on the port and put them to work. That is primarily like when this is discussed in the industry, that's the thing that kind of rises to the top. People are like, yeah, we like that. The downside on the concrete is the weight, right? But the weight is like my problem, not really like the port's problem. We can get the port to work to launch it. That's the industry downside, is like what I was talking about before. The weight to power ratio is a bit off with concrete. But okay. And then the advantages for steel is it's easier to handle, easier for the developer or the foundation assembler to handle, move around, bolt together, maybe goes a bit quicker, right? Yeah. So, you know, those are like the main kind of pros and cons for each material. Okay.
A question again on this time on concrete. You know,
Sure.
steel is obviously faster and cleaner. Concrete, what you didn't mention was the potential water quality threats and or air quality threats. Are those significant to you?
So those are real, and like those are part of the investi will be part of the CEQA investigation, right? Like figuring out. Okay, so for concrete, to make the decision for concrete and steel, like what I would say is for the industry, specifically with this news, you want to be able to do concrete. Like the industry is undecided in steel versus concrete, and both are going in the water. This is a recent announcement from France where they are building a commercial scale concrete foundation production facility in the south of France on the Mediterranean, right? So like they see this as a very viable, and not only very viable, the best ways to get floating wind started and get the foundations in the water, right? So like the industry there by no means has decided steel versus concrete. It's still very much like the industry is thinking of both. Okay, having said that, yeah, the concrete definitely needs to be evaluated for what you said, you know, the environmental effects of it. And that's part of the project. But like, you know, I don't like Shelley, correct me if I'm wrong here, but like I don't think we're there yet to be able to say exactly what those impacts are. It is, you know, you've got a large commercial, like waterfront industrial project happening. Whether the concrete batch plant is the thing that will make the permitting unviable, that's basically the question, right? And I don't think we know the answer to that yet. Like if that is the case, there's a lot of activities, a lot of different, like no, you know, like okay, like nothing that's like off, like horrible, but like you know, there are things generating noise already. There are things like with some emissions. So like, it's not like we're building a batch plant on a pristine place, right? There is the possibility that the batch plant kind of just becomes part of the terminal, and there's no real additional effects from it. But that's part of the project to figure that out.
Josh, this is a great deal. It would concrete bases need the same anti-fouling coatings as steel?
Yeah. Yep. You definitely would have anti-fouling on them. Yep. I don't know what the attachment rates are of a concrete versus steel, but yeah, you'll get it. You'll get growth on either without that. Yep.
And is that a play or anti-fouling agents applied like paint? Or are they mixed in with the concrete
Yeah,
throughout?
that I don't know. That I don't know.
We said that.
It yeah yep that I'm not sure of that I'm not sure of we could look a bit into that and see what the plan is for that. Yep. But yeah, you know what I would say is like
Maybe spike
all of
that.
those things will be considered, right? How these things are made, we will track it like basically from the delivery of the materials with like maybe you know you're gonna if you do steel you're gonna have the vessel deliveries. If you don't do steel, those vessels go away and they get replaced by the barge deliveries with the tugs coming, right? And you're going to have maybe some positive or negative impact there. And then we will walk the concrete through the full production, right? Running the batch plant, you know, maybe they're running 10 hours a day, whatever it is, running the batch plants, the emissions, all this stuff. And then the foundation's getting built, the SPMT is moving them, like all that stuff will be considered. And like you're saying, like if there's anti-fouling, and then like we can make an evaluation on, you know, if that's okay. And I think that's, yeah, I think that's it.
Thank you, Josh.
Chair Coleman, since Josh is on the East Coast and since this is fresh in your minds, I encourage you to do questions for each speaker one at a time.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Thank you. I guess first from the board, we had a few questions. Are there any additional questions for Josh?
Sorry.
Yeah, I guess I have a lot of questions. I was expecting the WTGs to be steel. I hadn't yet considered that they might be concrete and everything that comes with getting all those materials to the dock. So I guess one of my questions is, in creating a batch plant, are we now using roads to get more of our materials to the heavy lift marine terminal, or is it still, are those materials even for the batch plant coming? You know, coming via ship. How much ship traffic are we going to have moving concrete materials versus steel materials in terms of, you know, volume and capacity of the bay?
So yeah, remember, like these things over here, the white stuff is still all steel. We're just talking about the foundations here, right?
Yeah,
Like
I realize that, yeah.
So as far as the vessel traffic, what you'll have is like these boats are delivery vessels. And if we are doing steel, you're going to have a delivery vessels coming in here delivering foundation parts, and you're going to have that delivery vessels coming in here delivering component parts, right? Or the WTG parts. If we do concrete, this boat goes away totally. So all of those vi visits drop, and that gets replaced by barges carrying materials, right? So like that has to be evaluated, but it's not a full addition. You know what I mean? Like there's
I
a
see.
certain amount of steel boats that are coming in to feed the machine here, and those will go away and those will be replaced by barges. Like what the exact plus or minus there are is what we're looking at.
Okay.
But okay, and then like yes, the it probably would be not feasible to feed this thing via truck. Think what like you'd want to do is have the ability to bring in some trucks, but like have the primary feed be over water.
Yeah, understood. That's my question. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yeah, good question. Any other questions from the board?
Just an observation. You know, think about the tips of the jetties and the dolos that were built by out of concrete. We set up a plant, and they seem to be very successful. So I guess maybe there is something to that.
The like the tetrapods out that make up the jetty out there, you're saying? Okay, yeah. I mean, that's good information. Like if there had been a batch plant on the peninsula already and that was permitted, like that's good to know.
1970.
Okay. All right, yeah, very long ago, but I mean it's always good to have that, not, you know, like okay, like we're not the first people to do this. It's a long time ago, but you know, it's a good data point.
And Josh, and it's probably too early to be thinking about like what the makeup of the mix of the concrete would be. I know there's been a lot of work, but probably not for construction on this scale on looking at either alternative additives to concrete or different ways of producing concrete that are greener, at least to some degree.
Think about copper.
Is that, are there that would make it green?
It would be NFL.
Are there potential even to do that, to look at like alternative makeup in the concrete mix for this? And do you know if anyone's looking at that for these type of foundations?
So inside the marine industry, there's a huge push now to switch from like type two to, I think it's called like typically we use type two concrete. And there's a big push to, I think it's called type E, I'm not sure. But that is happening. That is like real and happening. And that is basically exactly that. Like like basically lower climate emission concrete. And when we build ports, it's pretty much universal that that's going in now. Whether that gets translated or not, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine yes. Like that is a very, very big push in the concrete industry. Like that's where they're headed. And like to make it for them to already make it to the port, like the materials that are in the marine environment, like it's, I think it's definitely possible that that would make it into the foundations.
Oh, it's good. All right. Going
I have a
to
question. Sorry.
Sure, go
Yeah,
ahead.
sorry. One more question, Josh. You may be the right person for this. I'm not sure, but that's. I'm understanding that the components for integration will be pre-painted. Will they be pre-lubricated, or will we be adding lubricant
Both.
in this area as
Yeah,
well?
it's both. It's both. But again, like they are coming ready to go, right? Like all the so the stuff with the lubricant is the nacelles, like the turbines. And they do have lubricants and oils in there. And there is some potential to service that or change some of it, but you are not getting like massive tankers with oil pumping it into the nacelles. Yeah, it'd be similar to the paint.
So there's no sort of topping off process before you send them to sea, something like that. They're completely full of fluid.
No. I'd have to confirm that. I have not seen that, but I don't believe that that's the case. Like they're built like, people always say that, and like you got to remember, like these guys that build these understand they're at ports, they're on the water, and then they're over the water. You know what I mean? Like obviously, yeah, stuff always happens, but there's definitely like part of the build and part of the way that they work is like self-contained, built ready to go. But that's something we could confirm.
And do you have a like a fair number? You may not have it the estimate yet, but on like what's the amount of gallons of fluid that each one of these might have? Are we at 200 or are we at 20,000? I really don't have any idea.
Yeah, that I don't know, but that's something we could probably find out. I don't know
Just
that.
looking at worst case scenario, you know, what if something happened? What's our liability in terms of a spill? What could it be? Yeah. It's fine. You can't answer that question. It's just one that I'm curious about.
All
right. Are there any questions from the public on this presentation? Please.
Hi, I'm Robin Gray Stewart. I'm the Marine Chair for our local Sierra Club. And I really appreciated what you said. I thought it was really informative. I know you're talking a lot about things that need to be evaluated, or we don't have the information yet. And so that's something that perhaps you're already thinking this direction, but I would just like to see a lot of transparency as you discover these things, rather than have all the studies and evaluations and then we learn about them as we go along. As a member of the Community Advisory Committee and the Green Terminal Committee, I would really like to see every little thing you discover as you discover it, so that we stay really informed on this and on top of it. Anyway, thank you very much.
Anyone else?
Hi there. Thanks so much, Amy Jester with the Core Hub. I really appreciate the presentation. There's just one clarification that I had. At one point, when you were describing the concrete foundation and the difference in how materials would be delivered to the site, you had noted that with concrete foundations, there would be much more truck traffic. And then later identified that the primary feed for supplies to the project would be by barge in the case of concrete. And so is the first what you were sharing initially related to truck traffic on site then, or is there something else that I missed between the two different comments that you made?
Well, so what I should have said is it can be delivered either by truck or by barge. And the primary way to do it would be by barge. And that's something that the port could enforce, right? Like as they were signing leases with various developers, they could say like, yep, all material will be delivered or whatever percent, would be delivered by barge. If you did do it by truck, it would be, there would be a lot of trucks coming in. But the best way to do it is waterborne transit.
Yeah, thank you. What I understood you to have said was that the amount of trucks that it would take to do this would be infeasible, pretty much. And so that's why it would be done by barge. Like if you tried to deliver that much material by truck, that would be an
It would be very
unwieldy
difficult.
amount of trucks.
Yeah.
Please come up to the podium and
I'm Ted Kuiper. I'm aquaculture. I'm really pleased to hear your dialogue with regard to concrete foundations, but I also would like to get more information from Moffett and Nichols about how this could impact ocean acidification. Because when we think in terms of concrete, you also think about those concrete foundations are going to be put in the water and they'll be held in Humboldt Bay for a number of months or longer. And so I'm very curious about what your scholarly works tell you about what's going on with ocean acidification from concrete foundations. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that would be part of the additional studies that we'd have to do and kind of like evaluating what the effects of that are. Yeah, I don't like have the answer to that. And I don't know, what, yeah, we don't know right now what the effects of that would be. I'm not sure the severity of that, what that would be, but it would certainly be part of the evaluation of the two materials, right?
I think one of the questions I think that we can will continue to have is that part of this is part of the project description, and then later on we'll see what you found out in the initial study under CEQA. So I think the aquaculture community would like to know what you find out about this data with regard to ocean acidification in the project description. Do it now rather than later. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I may, I think that's a interesting question because I don't have the data in front of me, but I'm sure like on a global scale, ocean acidification is primarily caused by carbon in the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels. But are there more localized water quality issues that would happen just in and around having these in the bay? I don't know if that's something that's been studied. I would be very confident in saying that like global ocean acidification is the impact of concrete is probably like extremely minimal compared to the impact of burning of fossil fuels local. Yeah. Please come on
Thank you,
up.
Stephen. I really appreciate your comment. I think that what we're most concerned about is local impacts. And because we have a large shellfish seed business and we're relying upon particular issues with regard to ocean acidification, especially with hatcheries, we've been working on that for many, many years with Sea Grant. So one way or another, we're going to have to answer this question whether or not we'd support the project if you don't have an answer with regard to ocean acidification locally, not
Yeah, and I think
internationally.
we're not trying to get into conversations here, but I think
I
that's where, yeah,
understand.
when you're saying like ocean acidification, I'm thinking of the like the larger global scale. we're talking about Humboldt Bay acidification
well,
on a local basis. I think that's something different.
Yeah, I think what we think about that is how's the local pH going to change? That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting question to say.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anything else on this presentation? Do we have any questions online? Well, Josh, thanks for staying up late in Boston for us. I guess we'll move on to the second presentation.
Shelly, you can have a chance here or at the podium, whichever you prefer.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shelly Anguera. I'm with Moffitt Nickel. I've been there for 7 years, and I've been studying marine ecotoxicology my entire career since graduate school. I wanted to share with you that we finished the sampling for the sediment characterization to determine the fate of the dredged material. And what we did is I'll just go through the results real quick just to share some observations. The materials are currently being tested. I don't know how to advance this. Let's see. Forward arrow. There we go. I got it. Okay, thanks. All right. So I just wanted to share, we just completed this in March. It was 12 very long days for the field crew. And the testing took, the sampling took longer than we expected. So we had some pretty long days. We were only able to collect about 3 cores on average a day. These cores were 20 feet long. And the material was very sandy. Much of it was sandy. And it took a long time to actually, it would take almost an hour to actually drive the vibrocore down and retrieve it. So this sampling is very different than the geoboring. The geoboring sampling will go down over 100 feet. This was just the top 20 feet to characterize the material for placement after construction, as it's being dredged. So we needed to have a certain amount of volume that then gets tested and goes to these various different laboratories from chemistry and bioaccumulation and toxicity testing and even grain size. And so we have to collect a lot of material, about 100 liters is collected and then divvied up between a bunch of different laboratories. So the type of equipment that we use just took a long time. When we, this whole sampling program went through all the regulatory agencies that review this, and they provided comments. We did this last January, a year ago, and we were hoping to get in the field last August, but then the funding stopped. So we, as soon as the funding started, we were out within 2 weeks because we were anxious to get this program going. There was over 200 different types of chemistry samples were actually collected. We won't analyze them all. What we were doing was collecting as many different types of samples. So should we get some interesting results, will we find some contamination and we really want to understand where the source of that contamination is, I have the ability to go back into frozen samples and reanalyze those to really isolate if we have certain types of chemistry in certain portions of the bay. So one big field event, collect the data as diverse as we possibly can to be able to answer a year's worth of questions. So you can see we collected different types of composites. We wanted to examine the top of the sediment. We wanted to examine the bottom of the core. We also wanted to characterize what's called the Z layer, which is supposed to be represent the post-dredge condition. So you want to always make sure when we're dredging that we're leaving the surface cleaner than what it was originally. It's one of the objectives in the dredging program. And so then there was all different kinds of composites. So that's all detailed in the sampling and analysis plan, which I believe is on the website. So happy to answer any questions. But this is just a graphic that describes the field observations. Each one of the circles was a sample that was collected. The original numbered samples were what was described in the sampling and analysis plan. What I want to draw your attention to is the guide off to this left. The orange highlighted samples were almost predominantly sand. So there was a lot of sand found on the site. And what you notice, though, is right in front of the existing wharf, it's actually mostly fine material. So this is really important. It gives us some ideas of what might be, you know, what kinds of uses those areas have had. Also, it tells you a lot too about the how swift the water is in those areas. The sands can be in very swift moving waters. The fines are accumulating in soft in quieter waters. I wanted to just draw your attention to if you see the yellow boxes there, those were areas where there was 2 feet of soft material sitting on top of sand. So that suggests that there might be some sloughing from the shoreline coming down. And from some of the geotechnical borings that have been done, it does seem like part of the design is requiring that the shoreline be stabilized because there is a potential for it to slough. So that's, you know, 50 years of sloughing has probably led to a little bit of this soft material sitting on the surface. It also is adjacent to the eelgrass, and we know that eelgrass likes to be in those softer fines. So that might explain why we're seeing eelgrass in those areas. The little red X's, there were 3 sites that we had to abandon, and I'll show you the pictures. So we did not complete sampling in those areas. And then the other thing that was very interesting is that the very northern portion of the site closest to the bridge, the sands there were so dense that we actually could not penetrate the fiber core through the surface. It was very fast moving water. It did go to the site during the test of the tides. But the vibe of the So normally when you have even 10% of fines, the core kind of stays open and you have a little bit of a slip to pull the core out. And that's what caused the sampling delays to took so long to collect these samples. So it's very nice from visually, it looks like very nice beach sand. So just to show you a little bit, this is the operation, about 28-foot vessel has an A-frame. They lower the vibro core over the side. And they did a lot of this, looking at the vibro core in the water, a lot of time. And then when they would bring the vibro core back, the cores were 20 feet long. We would then extract it there at the dock. And you can see this is the beginning. This is the very bottom of a core. And you can see how dry it's coming out. It is wet, but you can see it breaks apart as though it's dry. It's not really staying in a, you don't have the fines that are holding it together.
It's not cohesive.
Yeah exactly. There we go. So we set up, we had a really great area to lay out the cores. So we would collect the cores, and the process would be as you open it up, you then characterize it visually. We do tactile, we smell it. We're always smelling to try to see if we have any organic smells or petroleum smells. And then we then photograph the entire core and log it. And then we collect all those sample splits that we talked about. We take it and we composite it into all the different testing programs. But you can see there's steel bowls. Everything is washed and cleaned in between each sample so that we don't have cross-contamination. Every day we had all the ice chests are under chain of custodies. And so they're locked up and they're shipped with FedEx immediately to the laboratories. We didn't want to compromise anything. And then also just in case an ice chest goes missing, we're still in the field. It could go recollect a sample. Nothing's perfect, but thankfully all the samples were shipped properly. This is an example of some of the sand that we got specifically on the eastern bank there. It's really beautiful. It does look gray, but this would actually dry to white, you know, once it's dry. Mm-hmm. I'll show you some samples that were also some more variable. There was a few things that we did not follow the sampling planned protocol exactly as we had hoped for some conditions that happened. We document this. We share it with the regulatory agencies. I was on the phone with the EPA. I was on the phone with the regional board before we were out of the asking for a couple of variances in the sampling plan for reasons that we needed. And so they understood, and we, you know, modified our sampling in a couple places that were very difficult to get. We just had an agreement for me to go to 5 feet instead of the 20 feet. I talked about that one dredge unit 4 where we weren't able to penetrate. So we keep a very good dialogue going on with the regulatory agencies as we're sampling. So this is the three samples that we abandoned. The picture on the right-hand side is actually the eelgrass bed that's along the shoreline. And to sample for the permit compliance of this, we did not want to sample in the eelgrass. So we had moved what would normally be our desired sample location out of the eelgrass. And when we moved it out, we moved it too high up. We actually, even during high tide, it's actually on the border of the riprap. And now we know why eelgrass is not growing there. It was too rocky. We wouldn't have even been able to collect a core because there's kind of a crustal surface there that is just small rocks. So we took pictures of why we couldn't sample that documented it. And this is some of the samples I wanted to show you. There was along the eastern bank there, we did find one thing that was interesting is we did find some cobble and some rock in the surface of some of the samples, and not really sure where the source of that is. Gives you an idea that it's pretty swift moving. And then we did find some shell fragments over, you can see up right there along the coast. There were some shell fragments there. And then this is an example of the fine, almost all clay and silt that was right along the wharf, the old wharf. And you can see how different that material looks. We did smell it. There wasn't any petroleum odor. Most harbors look like this, so you can't really tell if there's any contaminants in it until you actually do the chemistry. But there was nothing, there wasn't like a rainbow that you often see with PAHs or, you know, petroleum products. We didn't see that. It just looked like it did smell organic, like it had detritus in it and old plants, you know, kind of maybe land type plants. So, but it looks like normal harbor mud. We'll know when we do the testing. So, and then here again is some of that sand. We also found a shell layer about 8 feet down, and this was really close to the middle of the channel. So it could be, it's probably really, you know, old, and it could have been at one point in the history of the harbor. There could have been, you know, a big population of this type of clam in that area. We don't know. But we have pictures of it, and we'll go ahead and analyze it and see what we find. So I think that was it. Oh, here's another one. This is on the right-hand side. That's the material that we weren't able to penetrate. It looks almost like a gravel, but its size is like that's about 2 to 3 millimeters is the gravel size. So it's still pretty small, like really, really coarse sands. So that's it. We right now we're in the middle. We get our first results from the toxicity test next week. The first test that comes down is our most sensitive toxicity test. It's with an amphipod. It's a 10-day exposure. And then we start I take those results. I'm also getting the chemistry results next week. And I write up a memo for the EPA and for Cal Fish and Wildlife. And I write up a memo and I make a recommendation for what the bioaccumulation testing should be. I give them the early toxicity results. We have a phone call about it. We confirm what should be analyzed. And then the bioassay tests, which are the long-term 28-day exposures, are put into the containers. And when they come out, we then analyze their tissues on what was agreed to by the resource agencies. So that's it. We hope to have the results of the whole testing program in July, and it will go to the regulatory agencies again. And in that, we will ask for a determination. Do you believe that these test results demonstrate that the material is suitable for placement in the marine environment? Yes, no. And if no, where is it suitable? And we ask them for that determination. And then that determination goes into the permits. And that allows for us to make certain assumptions about construction. So that's the whole program. We just wanted to share with you because it is really great to get sand. There's a lot of things you can do with sand, especially the beneficial use workshop. You know, we know people want to put sand on beaches. And so we have a potential, as the construction goes on, we have potential of placing that material on a beach, which is good. I'll take any questions.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions or comments from the board?
I always have questions. Sorry, y'all. Bad guy.
That's fine.
Thank you, Dr. Anguera. That is super exciting to just see that work. I love it to see it. That's a lot of cores. Shell fragments. That mm-hmm. doesn't immediately bring up red flags, but we are in Wiat country. And so how do you differentiate, you know, between shell fragments that might be, you know, relic shellfish beds or, you know, from midden material? I guess, you know.
Yeah, I'm not qualified.
Okay.
Does
this process involve some determination around that?
There, not for this investigation, okay. But we do have the data that demonstrates at what elevation those shell fragments were found.
Right.
And, you know, as a marine scientist, I find shells at all different depths all over the place. Yeah. So to me,
they're mobile. I get that.
It's very common to see different animals come in and die off at different times under different kinds of events. And so to see shell fragments is pretty standard,
yeah.
especially around when there was some shell around the old wharf, that's really indicative, and especially the way they were, that's kind of indicative of things that might fall off the wharf too. Yeah. So it's pretty standard to see shell fragments that are related to something that was bound and then sloughed off from there. But you're right. I did not look at it from that perspective, but we do have another sediment program coming up, and there are going to be geoborings going through many of these same locations. So there's another opportunity.
At any point, will there be somebody who's more on the anthro or archaeological side who will look at any of those shell fragments?
They are welcome to come. Everybody was invited for this one. The notice went out, and the days that we were sampling, it was there. I do know that for the next sampling event that is planned, we're trying to plan it the first 2 weeks of May. And in that program, there has already been coordination for people to come and observe the cores. And I think it will lend itself well. I think in 2 days, we'll have 12 cores laid out that would be easy for people to come look at.
Sure. Also, just from agricultural nutrient perspective, does the bioassay process kind of pick up where there might be excessive nutrients? We have some species kind of bloom or come up, and how do we know like nutrient levels?
So based on these, I would, without any finds, there's no ability to hold on to nutrients in this material.
Yeah, right.
So the fact that we're in fast moving waters, the fact that they're, we'll know with organic content in the analyses, we would know. But I didn't see anything. The only potential, I think, area where there could be some nutrients is really going to be where those fines were.
Yeah.
And it might even be close to the eelgrass beds. But like even like what we showed, though, is that a lot of that, for the majority of the area, this finds are really limited to the very surface and not the majority of the material that's being dredged.
I understand that the great majority of this are sands, and they're not sterile, but they're near.
Yeah.
Some of them are near that. How about just the last thing? And this is really on behalf of you know, shellfish industry here, is dinoflagellate cysts is a big concern of the shellfish industry here. Is there any way that these samples are going to make any determinations about their presence or absence?
No, we're not analyzing for dinoflagellates or spores in the samples.
Okay, fair. Thank you.
Yeah.
Commissioner Benson, I'll just let you know that the next sampling event, one tribe has asked to observe. So at least one tribe will participate in that picture you saw of the processing at the next round.
Good. Thank you so much.
Any other questions?
Any other questions from the board? One thing that Craig brought up made me wonder, is there any ability in those cores to get any dates or tell like at what date certain depths were laid down, or is that kind of out?
I mean, the science is out there to do that. You can do cesium, which is when the it's isotope sampling for different depths. You can do that. We did not do that. I'm trying to think. No, I mean, that's not usually part of a dredge characterization program.
Yeah,
you know, aging the sediments.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure.
Yeah. But, you know, what we did look, and part of the characterization and developing the sampling and analysis plan, is we really did look at sedimentation. And part of the design is estimating how much maintenance dredging would have to be done. So this system does not seem to have a huge amount of sediments moving. And if you look at, you've got just a, you know, 10,000 cubic yards of material settling in that entire basin every 3 years. And that is equivalent to only 1 to 2 feet accumulating in the Navy, in the Army Corps, just on the edge. And it really looks to be something to me when I look at how that sediment is accumulating. It's really just kind of ship movement and water movement is remobilizing and then coming in and hitting the Army Corps. So there's not a lot. It's not like you're at the end of a river where you have a huge amount of deposition. For example, in San Francisco Bay, you're going to dredge 10 feet every single year. And here we have dredging 1 foot every 3 years. That's only in a portion, you know, over a very large area. So it's a very small amount of sediment movement. And we also do studies as part of this study program, as part of how we estimate what we think the maintenance dredging is going to be. We do sediment transport modeling, and you can just see the sediments just kind of go back and forth and back and forth. You don't have a massive amount of deposition. So going down 20 feet would be a very long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, and we did have questions when we were developing the sampling and analysis plan. And, you know, pretty much the consensus was, is that the last 100 years is only in the, it's in less than the top 5 feet.
Yeah.
So it's over 100 years, but we don't have the data. So when I have the chemistry data, I'll be able to say, you know, a little bit more of where the anthropogenic chemicals are starting to show up. And what is considered native background material, very older materials.
I also thinking a little bit what you're maybe getting at with the possibility of midden. It would seem it's, like if the shell placement is from any sort of architectural, which I would consider a midden like an architectural thing, it would have to have considerable depth. So it would, I don't know if like the shells that you pulled up were like 7 to 14 feet. In the column or a very small
they were
column.
7 feet below the surface.
But like the column of...
Up 20 feet. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. That seems like that would indicate like placement. But if it's just like a narrow layer of shell, that wouldn't seem like that was placement. But
one tsunami.
But yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. It was fascinating.
Yes.
Oh, go ahead, Greg.
I have a question. Okay, so... That was awesome. This is really cool. I think this kind of information is extremely valuable. But so did you, and I don't know if the Corps, when the Corps did the deepening project, they removed a lot of sediment from the turning basin right next to where you were doing all your mm-hmm. sampling. I don't remember seeing samples.
We're outside of it. Basin. Yeah.
They actually had to stop using a cutterhead dredge and bring in a clamshell dredge because it was so hard to dredge there that the cutterhead dredge wouldn't dredge. And so I there may be some information in their report. I don't know what that report looks like because I was not even born when they did that in the 90s. The other thing that I think is interesting.
You're looking really good for 30.
Yeah. Did you see any? Was there any evidence of geologic fractures or any? What's the term I'm looking for?
There's major stratification.
Yeah, any stratification fault?
No, we didn't find that in this 20-foot investigation. And when the geoborings go out, they will go down along the wharf. They go 160 feet below the surface. And in the outer, on the western bank, they'll go 100 feet. And so in that kind of investigation is when we're going to see big shifts in geologic layers in that program. And they're the geologists, and they're doing other types of tests that look at the matrix of the sediment. You know, so which I'm I'm not looking at it from that perspective. So we'll get that analysis and that evaluation.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah.
It's super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else? All right. Anything from the public? Any questions, comments? And anything online?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and expertise.
Yeah.
Is that the end of our presentation?
So that's a certain.
All right. Well, thank you. We're all getting a education on education. We're feeling edumacated here. New business. Consideration of initial fiscal year 2026-2027 budget preparation. Step one, preliminary goals for Woodley Island Marina, Fields Landing Boatyard, and related dredging.
Okay, for the purpose of the presentation, the dredging activities are included in these. Remember, these are preliminary expenses related to capital projects. These are not the ongoing expense. We bring the budget back with all the recurring expenses, personnel expenses, operational expenses, as well as projected revenues as a draft budget, and we bring the final budget. So these are, again, the capital projects, again, focusing on Woodley Island Marina, Fields Landing Boatyard, and related dredging. So as you saw last year, we had a goose egg in for dredging. We are still working with FEMA. You know, there's a very large backlog of FEMA projects. Nationally, there's been a lot of effort by federal administration, state administrations to loosen that up. Well, we have seen some improvement.
Maybe you could teleport the material. Isn't that FEMA?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll keep my...
No, it's okay. I mean, it's silly that we made an application in January of 2023.
Teleport all the material to the Waffle House.
Yeah, to the Waffle House. 2023, and here we are still, you know, approved, but we can't seem to get a program together. So that'll come back later in our deferrals, but unfortunately, it appears that it's going to be the current activity. Dock improvements, $20,000. This is, again, for weldments, whalers, a major dock components, not rub boards or the basic day-to-day maintenance, but replacement of weldments mainly. We are also going to pull out a finger that is twisted like an old piano player. I play piano. My fingers are getting pretty twisted. But we're going to see if we can rebuild that ourselves, and that'll be an experimental project. We have plenty of stock materials to do that, but we're coming up with very creative ways to improve the float system around here, and there are great needs for that. General security, $10,000. You've been supporting us in adding new cameras in and around the marina. We also are looking at access control systems and improving our door locks, because remember, we have a population that lives here on the island and a very large daily population. So having digital access control is almost necessary at this point. Some improvements to the general district office. And then flat roofs. So I'm happy to share with you, through a lot of persistency and work with Al's Roofing as a vendor who's been able to source tiles for our roof, we had a winter with only one roof leak. Is amazing for us since we're usually dealing with dozens. We've replaced a considerable number of tiles. We've done a lot of carpentry work over the years and a lot of ceiling. So we're down to our flat roofs, and we have, because we've made some very strategic hires in recent months, we have a experienced roofer on staff now, as well as one more returning to us. They'll be coming back onto our team probably in the next month. So the labor part will be from our personnel expense, but the flat roof, and I rounded everything off to the nearest, you know, $500,000, $10,000, $15,000 mark. But we think we'll be able to take care of our flat roofs this year. So major victory. There's a large value in here for general carpentry. And on most of these flat roofs, because of the design and the way the penetration happens in connection to a large lodgepole, there's been an extreme amount of rot. And these aren't rafter tails that you can cut back a little bit, or areas that you can maybe take a section out and sister is a term you often hear. This is full-on replacement. So we have to get a prototype, bring it over to the building department for a like-for-like replacement permit. We'll have a large-scale general carpentry plan to replace a lot of the roof trusses on our flat roofs. And we go with the bed. There we go. Marina lighting, continue to replace light, exterior lighting in and around the marina. We've been transitioning to LED fixtures or LED bulbs where we can't replace the fixtures. Usually there's a retrofit there that works for us. You've heard me talk about a cutting room with the North Coast growers so we can have fresh cut fish here on the island. So we're ready to pull the trigger on that. But we just haven't been able to find the funds. So I want to ensure that we put those funds in the budget. Remember, this is not only revenue producing, but more importantly, it's supportive of our fishers. Asphalt seal and striping. Again, this is self-performing. We just do not have the resources to go out and hire this, but we have a large workforce. So we'll be self-performing those activities. Those are materials. And then our landscape and planning budget. This is a big cut from last year, $7,500. We've made a lot of nice improvements to the landscape. But there's still quite a bit more that needs to go. So a few years ago, we were in a position to spend, you know, $250,000. We're just not in those positions right now. We're also not overestimating revenues, so this should be a pretty good fit. We've got to pinch that the piggy bank and tighten the belt a little bit. Access roads, we're deferring by $7,500. Those are large areas of very degraded asphalt due to tree roots primarily. So we're going to not be able to take care of those. The concern there is we might be able to find another $7,500, but it's when we open that up and what we do and we get into a large tree removal project. Do we have a large export where we have to build back the base and put it in? So we could, you know, have 4 or 5 times that expense very easily. So we're going to have to continue to just patch some of those areas, put cones out, et cetera, traffic calming. I'm trying to nurse that on another year. Of the canopies and decks that I talked to the roof replacement, there's, you know, we have the portion we're going to spend, but we still have to defer the remainder to a coming year. And then there's the dreaded dredging expense. And so, you know, it's a deferral at this point in time. If we get the FEMA money, we can always change course. We know we have a certain window that we can dredge in, and we have to notify the agencies and submit, you know, all the appropriate plans, but we do possess the permits necessary. Fuels Landing Boatyard.
Can we go back to lighting? Just have a question on lighting on Woodley Island, marina lighting. Are there any opportunities here to preview lighting that might be used at the heavy lift marine terminal so that people could come and see what that looks like? Or is it just apples and oranges all?
I would argue it's probably apples and oranges.
Okay. All right, yeah. Just ask.
Thank yeah, you. No, good question, but probably not applicable. And we use a very low candle power light here. At night because of our wildlife area, yeah. Of course, our little board tenants.
Okay.
We do have the ability to tamp down lighting as well. So we do have some lighting. I forget the term. I'm going to call it phase lighting. It's not what it is, but we can have more candle power for a period of time and we can drop that candle power down. And it's just, it's a kind of a dual switching program is really what we have.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Wash water off.
Go ahead. That there, are likely going to be commercial lighting opportunities.
I sure hope so.
Launched,
yeah,
within the next couple months through Burton Coast Industry Authority.
That's outstanding. That, as you know, that's where we were really working on prior to COVID, and then they have we've had a couple assessments from our CEA, which we very much appreciate, but we haven't found the opportunities. That's great information.
Thank yeah, you. It's been like the previous programs have all been through like statewide programs, and so there'll be a locally operated program launching here within a few months.
Awesome. Thank you. Good news. Good news. So our watch water operations, which are our general best management practices in around boat washing, and that's just increasing our arsenal of equipment. So that would be things like evacuation sanders, meaning sanders that evacuate the dust immediately at the time of surfacing. We are looking at a couple of sweepers that are manual types, but we can use them around the boatyard for people cleaning up as they're going. We've been increasing that each year. This would be a capital expense to buy specific equipment. And our firm water pretreatment, Mike's been super good about working with us on this. You know, we've really had a little bit of a challenge here. We tried to, this is the first item I brought to the board as an ED, January or maybe it was even December of 23. And we have not, I mean, we went through financial hell with grants being pulled and cash flow issues, really does carry these grants. So we are full speed ahead this year. I'm very happy to do that. Mike and his team are working on an RFQ that we can launch here very soon. And in that, what we're going to do is we're going to have all of the in-ground work bid, or all the underground connections, you know, if you will, sticking up out of the ground, and having our crew self-perform and all of the above ground. Maybe a little more detailed than that, but simply put, that's how we plan to accomplish that. And we're working, Mike's team is working diligently on that, and I really appreciate Mike and one of his team members taking some time to sit down in their conference room to be get creative on how the heck we can pull this off. So.
So we're at something like a 95 PS&E design, 95%.
It'll be a full set of bid documents, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Build and bid, it'll be the total package.
Okay.
Travel lift straps, this is something that we had to defer last year. So bringing $25,000 for that. Continuing to do repairs down there. This is to buy materials to paint the building, but again, self-performing. General repairs and maintenance. We don't have a recurring maintenance budget at Fields Landing Boatyard because, again, the onus of this is put on the tenant, but he does need some support down there, and there are landlord retained areas. Maintaining the south pad, that really is just an annual debris removal. And when you operate a large industrial facility, things collect. And they don't always belong to the landlord, but it seems like each and every year things assemble there, they're abandoned there, et cetera. So we have a cleanup down there, and yeah, we'll leave that one alone. And pinching that belt once again, there's quite a bit of asphalt sealing that needs to occur out there. There's siding and trim, which needs to be replaced on the building, but we continue to fasten it. Don't know about dredging. Part of that was, you know, when we dredge, can we dredge down at Fields Landing Boatyard in terms of the fingers? But we also are having some challenges with the U.S. Army Corps and really not focusing on dredging the South Channel any longer. And so there's a little bit of work to be done there. And it's not an absent conversation. It's a prioritization. Finally, travel lift tires. We are continuing to buy recaps. That is not what is like, but what we'd like to do, but it's what we have to do to keep an operation going. Also with travel lift tires, believe it or not, they are very difficult to come by. So we may be in a situation someday where we have to buy them. Right now we're using aircraft tire as casings and having them retreaded or putting caps on them. And that's what we're using on the travel lift. So far so good. So that's our report.
Thank you. Any questions on the board on the preliminary budget?
Hey, since this was the Woodley Island section was on here, and there's recently the boat over in the Eureka Marina that settled down to the bottom. How are we with, do we have derelict vessels in the marina? And
pardon the chuckle.
You want to buy a boat?
Yeah, exactly. How is that incorporated in our budget and planning?
It's not. We deal with that in general day-to-day maintenance costs, expense costs, and really the bulk of that is through a couple of different ways. So if you'll remember at the last board meeting, or maybe it was even the meeting prior, you approved and had a resolution for us to receive the Secretariat grant through California Department of Fish and Life, OSPR. That's specific to the Harbor Safety Committee, but those grants also include our replenishment grants that we buy materials for OSPR response trailers. You also may remember that we've been communicating with OSPR on trying to secure support to fill a trailer that we own that's not currently used that we would like to turn into an OSPR and place in other areas within our jurisdiction. And so typically when there is a boat sinking or a leak, those materials, that's what they're there for. Sometimes we bill back for those materials because we have a boat owner who takes responsibility and says, hey, can I use your materials? Other times we don't know where the source is, so those are there. We also keep a pretty good stock on hand to be preemptive. And maybe we will get authorization to board a boat, or in a real extreme situation, we will get on there, try to do what we can to stop the leaking and to pump the vessel so it doesn't sink. And then to date, we've been very fortunate with our derelict vessels. Each one that sunk, we've had an owner that has participated and helped. I believe in the last, let's just say 5 years, we've had at least three that come to mind immediately. We have the SAVE grant, which is a grant that we get for the Surrendered Abandoned Vessels program to the California Department of Boating Waterways or California Natural Resources Agency. And we are removing, I believe, 6 vessels this year that will be demoed underneath that program. And we push on the U.S. Coast Guard very heavily. The U.S. Coast Guard, with the proper investigation, has the ability to issue what's known as a Notice of Federal Interest, or a NOFI. And if you have one of those on your boat, you're going to snap into shape pretty darn quick. And oftentimes, if we post one on a boat, we'll ask them to also post it at the head of the dock, especially if we're not certain what boat it is. You know, we're looking for information. The Coast Guard has that authority. We do not. Some of the Coast Guard MSD people, Marine Safety Detachment, for those who don't know what MSD is, are much more aggressive than others. We had a great one for a long period of time. They're all good people. They all work very, very well. You know, there's no question about the quality of the folks at the U.S. Coast Guard. But we do find that certain people that run that group are much more aggressive than others. And something new, sorry to belabor this, but you asked the question.
No, it's interesting because it is an issue.
It's a huge challenge. NOAA now has a federal officer here, and he routinely walks the docks and monitors things and has interactions. So that's very good. I think, like anything, prevention, they always say, you know, what's the best first aid prevention? It's really about our staff doing daily dock walks. And if we see a boat that's taking on water, listing to one side, immediately contact the boat owner, if appropriate, put a pump on the boat, pump the boat, take the water off of it, and ensuring that we have a marina manager who's in constant communications with our tenants. So the true answer to your question is, you know, how do we handle it? Prevention.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate the well thought out answer on that.
We live it every day.
Anything from the public on the budget preparation? All right, moving on. Spending some more money. Authorize the executive director to amend the not-to-exceed amount for the current Moffitt and Nickel contract from $10,819,388 to $12,175,242 to incorporate remaining funds from the CEC grant OSW 21001 and extend the end date to April 31st, 2027.
Okay, this is actually quite simple. This is an administrative action for clerical purposes. So we had original funds that were received through OSW 21, in which we went through a competitive process and secured Moffitt Nickel as the consultant for the project. We awarded an original contract to Moffitt Nickel. Thereafter, we received, excuse me, let me take some back. That was a combination of OSW-21 funds and MARAD or PIDP funds. We then received and entered into a cooperative agreement with Caltrans for eelgrass. And then that eelgrass cooperative agreement, we received an additional $560,000, let's say as a round number. And it was approved, and we modified the contract and brought it up to a value of $10,819,388. As luck would have it, we were able to spend only a portion of the Port Infrastructure Development Program funds. So we ended up in a situation we were short on the original $10.3 million that was authorized. In the OSW-21 funds, we had additional funds that were to be used as a match to infra. But because infra went away, those funds sit in the OSW-21 fund. Keep in mind, funds aren't necessarily dollar for dollar, and they aren't used for any specific purpose. They're laid out very early in the agreement how they're going to be used, and it's based on budget scope and certain tasks within those scopes. So now we're in a situation where, in order to complete the project, we have to move some of those funds that now are not there from PIDP. OSW-21 funds will replace those. In this case, the amount that we're able to work on is the difference figure here to take us to $12,175,242. So you're authorizing the change, and I believe it's $1,355,854.
So I'll offer a motion to authorize the executive director to increase the not to exceed amount by $1,355,804. And then I would invite anybody here to encapsulate what he just said into 2 minutes or less.
I was like a minute 18.
I'll second the motion.
That was awesome, Chris.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion, questions on this item?
You know, if Joshua Singer and Shelly Anguera hadn't given such brilliant performances today, I was a no on this, but you know, you can tell your bosses.
It's because of you. $1,300,000. Any comments, questions from the public? All right, hearing none, we can bring it back for a vote. I think it was a simple vote, right? So all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. Item 12. We are adjourned.
Congratulations from the beginning.
Good job. Excellent. Oh, you're